Welcome back to Elder Sign, a weird fiction podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Brandon Buda.
And I'm Glenn McDorman. This episode, we're going to be talking about the short story called The New People by Charles Beaumont. This was published in 1958. This is a story that I am super excited to cover. For one, it was nominated by one of our awesome Patreon supporters. And of course, then the rest of our Patreon supporters voted for this on the ballot. And I just want to say thank you to all of them for participating in our process here of letting us off the hook of ever having to actually think about and choose stories again. But what makes me most excited about this is that Charles Beaumont is a huge name in weird fiction, a huge name in speculative fiction, maybe more broadly than that, as one of the big writers for the Twilight Zone, the classic Twilight Zone of the 1950s and early 1960s. But I have actually never read a single one of his prose stories. This is my first time, and I think the story was awesome, and I'm super excited to talk about it.
This story is really awesome. I mean, it's kind of about, I don't know, what is a suburb? Who lives there? Why do they live there? What's going on with the American family? All this kind of weird stuff caught up in the story. Things that you might expect to see in a great classic Twilight Zone episode, or kind of like a really good season two X-Files episode. But this is pretty dark. This is way more on the X-Files scale rather than the Twilight Zone scale. So why don't we just get into it right away, Glenn, because I think we're both pretty excited to talk about this story.
Yeah. So the story is set contemporary to its writing. So we're in the middle of the 1950s. We are in, as you said, Brandon, suburban America. I think it's really suburban LA. And we're enjoying this booming post-war economy. And in this case, we really means Hank and Ann Prentice, as well as their son, Davy. We're going to learn later in the story that Davy is adopted, and we'll also learn why the Prentices chose to adopt a child rather than to conceive one of their own. But for right now, what matters is that they have only just recently moved into their fine suburban single-family house. Really, this was just about a month ago. And the deal is that there is a stain in part of the wallpaper that just won't go away. What the stain is no mystery here. The family knows that the previous owner killed himself by slitting his own throat. And there is some tension between Hank and Anne about this. Hank is, well, he's just uncomfortable here in this house, and he thinks that something is wrong with this place. But Anne loves it here, and she is just not going to go back to their cramped apartment in the city. So all of this setup, all of this is very, very obviously, right, setting us up for a classic haunted house story. We've got a family that's just moved in. We've got a family with some tension, possibly even some dysfunction that they're actually just trying to ignore and hope goes away. And then we've got a house with a traumatic death. This is just a fantastic opening full of classic hooks. I was excited at this point.
It actually has so many hooks that the hooks occlude where the story is actually headed. And it's a technique I don't know that I've really encountered before in a short story, where the reader is so overwhelmed by the opening hooks that you think there's no way that the author, you know, in this case, it's Beaumont, will be able to pull it all together. Glenn, I mean, you mentioned the haunted house hook, which includes the family new to the house where something grisly has occurred. So we also need, in part, a detective story. Somebody needs to figure out what happened there. But as you also said, that's not really the mystery here. But we need to know what's going on behind the suicide in order for all of that part of the hook to be resolved. Then we've got the strange adopted kid. You know, what is their role going to be? Why are we told the kid is adopted? Is there something wrong with them? Then we've got the family getting ready for a big party. And it's just so much going on. And then suddenly it's time to meet the neighbors. And that's really the focus of where we are in this opening of the story. That's all in the opening scene where all of these hooks kind of emerge. But one thing that we do know for sure at the opening of the story, like in terms of what is Beaumont baiting us for, but like in terms of facts, is that Hank Prentice carries this sense of responsibility for not speaking up about his feelings about the house. You know, he never liked the house to begin with. So Hank kind of carries this burden of guilt around because he really wants to offer Anne some happiness. He thinks Anne is unhappy because of him, and he wants to do everything he can to make her happy. Hank is also concerned about Davy's happiness, too. There's no kids in the neighborhood for Davy to play with. Hank kind of carries this burden of responsibility for making his family happy. All of that will be underscored by more that we learn about Hank in a little while, but I guess at the opening, what Beaumont is just saying here is like, hey, there's a lot going on. Buckle up. I'm going to take you for a ride. Don't try to figure it out yet. You know, just have fun with this one.
And I don't think there is any way to figure out from this first page, from this first scene, where this story is going. Certainly where it ends is not at all where it started, and certainly not at all where I thought it was going to go after reading this first scene, which I think is absolutely brilliant storytelling. But I'm getting way ahead of us here. I promised earlier that we would talk about their son, Davy, and his adoption. Davy, we don't get, you know, an explicit age for Davy, but he's at least 8. He might even be a little bit older than that, but, you know, he's not in high school or something like that. And the reason that Hank and Anne chose adoption over conceiving their own child is that they couldn't conceive their own child. And that is because Hank has some kind of erectile dysfunction. Now, my thinking here was that Hank is basically Jake from The Sun Also Rises, and that this was a wartime wound, maybe Korea, maybe the Second World War. We may have to talk about that in the discussion because, you know, this condition is, and surprisingly so, but it's crucial to the plot. So, okay, with that out of the way, let's actually go get to that plot. As you said, Brandon, Hank and Anne are hosting a housewarming party so that they can get to know the people in their neighborhood a little bit better. And these people are all affluent professionals. They're corporate executives, they're engineers, accountants, that sort of thing. There's also a Hollywood writer. It feels kind of like Charles Beaumont has maybe written himself into this story a little bit, or maybe just people he knows. But Hank is not really interested in this party. And at least some of that is because of these misgivings that he's having about the house. He doesn't feel comfortable in the house. He doesn't seem either to feel comfortable about the neighborhood. And so he doesn't really want to get to know these neighbors. But as you said, Brandon, he is doing all of this for his wife. But Davy also is not into this party. And in fact, he has asked if he can just be completely excused from it because he absolutely does not want to see the neighbors. And it becomes evident that Davy has seen some of the neighbors doing something bad or weird, and they have seen him seeing them. Also, it becomes clear that Anne knows all about this, but Hank does not, and there is no time for him to get the details before the guests start arriving. And so we don't get these details before the guests start arriving either, and it's all very, very ominous. So we've really shifted gears here about, you know, what's the creepiness? What's the shadow that is hanging over this family here as Beaumont builds the story? And it does get even more ominous during the party when one of the guests, and this is actually the Hollywood writer whose name is Matt Distel, Matt keeps telling Hank that he and his family need to get out. Not next week, not tomorrow, tonight. They need to get out for their own safety. Now, Hank ignores this, and some of the other men at the party are actually aware that Hank has a low opinion of the neighborhood and also has some weird ideas about what goes on here, and so they are warning Hank against Matt Distel at the same time that Matt Distel is trying to tell Hank to pack up and get out of here as soon as possible. But after the party has ended, Distel calls Hank on the telephone and asks him to come over to his house and to do so secretly because they're watching. Now, Hank is going to do this, but we'll have to come back to that because this is, I think, actually where we should pause to talk about this big change in tone from haunted house story to, well, to something else.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Everything in this story, as you've been really pointing out, feels pretty off in general. And now we've reached this point in the story where somebody's got to take action. It really has to be Hank, since he's our point of view character, to figure out what is going on behind all of these mysterious and ominous elements hanging over the story. And Distel is Hank's best chance at figuring out what's going on. Also the reader's best chance, but we also know this is probably not a good idea at all. Before we get into that, though, I want to return to the pre-party section of the story where you really see the Prentice family dynamic emerge. You know, as I've been pointing out, Hank feels deeply responsible for everyone's well-being and happiness. And to me, this is what Hank feels like he can contribute to the family, as he's impotent and he's maybe overcorrected for that in these other ways. Maybe Anne is taking a little bit advantage of Hank's condition, you know, in terms of getting what she wants out of it. And then ultimately she seems kind of fine with that, like kind of just getting what she wants out of life in a material sense. And then Davey is busy in his own world, as kids are. He rides bike around the neighborhood. He catches his neighbors get up to stuff that like the men in room 213 are up to in The Shining probably. And like his his mom doesn't trust him. Because Davey is a threat to her happiness. If what Davey says is true, Anne's whole kind of, facade of happiness built on materiality and material wealth is going to crumble. And so there's really a scathing critique of American consumerist norms here in the story, of something like we might even be able to think of as like a kind of consumer consciousness and like this guilt that surrounds that. And this is like a really dark and uncomfortable story. And I think so much of the discomfort arises from that recognition that there might be something very wrong just with the basic social norms and mores that push us purely towards our own enjoyment and self-satisfaction in a material sense. And Beaumont has given us this picture of American contentment as advertised to the people who are living the suburban lifestyle. And it's kind of bled into the family life, the family dynamics in the story. You know, what happens to the parent who stays at home looking at catalogs and wondering how to upgrade their life with consumer goods? Like, this is in the story. This bit of consumer critique is present in the housewarming gifts portion of the story. And then there's a question of what happens to the parent who feels the only good they can do is to pass their money around. You know, is that real power? Is, you know, potency kind of caught up in the ability to make money? What happens to kids who, being outside the social order, witness the rot of the social order and no one really believes them or is doing anything about it? And this is all here at the start of the story, you know, before the party. Some of this we'll go into in our discussion for sure, but I kind of wanted to, I don't know, make the bed, I guess, of this, or make the case for this type of stuff in the story. Boredom also plays a big role in this too, but I think we'll save that topic solely for the discussion.
Right, because what we're about to get from Distel here is really peering behind the curtain, right? Breaking the facade of the glitzy, glittering, shiny materiality of suburbia to get at what's behind that, and the darkness in particular and ugliness that's behind that. I mean, it's, you know, the exact plot of a zillion different TV shows, like, I guess, including The Twilight Zone, for that matter. And so, yeah, I'm glad that you did more of the groundwork there than I've been doing in the recap.
Yeah, I think it's pretty important to this story, and it's strange. I mean, I don't know. We'll get into this in our discussion, so I'll just hold off making any more comments here. I don't actually have too much to say about the party. I guess this party is also dealing with morals or something like that. You know, what's going on? You know, one of the morals might be here if your domestic partner is unable to have sex, don't spread that news around the neighborhood. It should be obvious that you shouldn't let writers hang around free booze. You know, that's another moral of the story here. But I guess the real point of all this is that those hooks that we talked about at the beginning of this story are slowly coming in to, you know, service the story in terms of showing us exactly what kind of plot we're in. Something is definitely off with the neighbors, and maybe that has to do with the suicide for some reason, but the house is, you know, as you say, Glenn, definitely not haunted. Distel is weird and everything is off. And so now we need to get some answers.
Right. So Hank slinks over to Distel's house around midnight. And then when he gets there, even sneaks in through the back door. And as we're expecting, Distel has a story to tell. The families in this neighborhood are in a sort of thrill-seeking club. That's kind of a polite term that I'm using there, but we'll keep it that way, thrill-seeking club. And initially, it was the basic tawdry stuff like spouse swapping, key parties. But then later, this advanced to some more criminal and also more bizarre activities. I mean, these people robbed a bank, they burnt down a warehouse, they even brought down an airplane. I mean, they killed people by doing this. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, according to Distel. For a while, they got into this phase where they were recreating horrifying scenes from literature and history. This included things like the execution of Marie Antoinette and the murder of Hamlet's father. And, you know, to carry this out, I mean, fortunately, there's actually a pretty good supply of people willing to make a buck who also won't be missed by anyone, which is to say, they were going around getting prostitutes to come play the roles of these people that they were going to kill. And as you will have already guessed, I think at this point, the group here played a suicide lottery, and that is why there is a bloodstain in Hank's house. But lately, now, they've gotten into the occult, which is to say devil worship, and even just last week, they slaughtered a dog as part of this activity. Now, Hank is obviously, and rightly, I think, skeptical about this story, though we cannot help but think about his son Davy's claim to have seen something, something that made him just want to lock himself in his room during this housewarming party. But still, Hank needs proof, and Distel's going to give it to him. So the two of them sneak through the neighborhood backyards until they get to the house of the leader of this group. And lo and behold, there in the basement is the whole rest of the neighborhood, clearly engaged in some very obvious devil worship. And they have brought something in a blanket, and they are clearly going to stab it. And I say something, but obviously it's someone. And I assumed this was Davy, because, you know, we've known since the very beginning that Davy feels endangered here. But it is not Davy wrapped up here. It is Anne instead. And you might think that now is time for some heroics from Hank and Distel, but it's not that type of story. Because, you see, Distel hasn't actually been trying to warn Hank or to help him in any way. What he did was get Hank out of the house so the rest of the group could get Anne without a struggle. And they wanted Anne because they have to sacrifice a virgin woman for their ceremony, and Anne has been confiding, yeah, way too much in people she's just met about Hank's physical condition here, his erectile dysfunction. And, you know, Distel doesn't mind explaining all of this to Hank because Hank isn't going to survive the night. Anne certainly is not. And neither is Davy. And that's the end of the story.
Yeah, it's a rough ending. You know, the never, ever move into a house where a violent death has taken place unless you yourself are a kind of rough and tumble ghost hunter type, or I don't know, there's some economic necessity that puts you there, which is usually what the root of these stories is. I'm pretty much ready to launch right into the discussion. But before we do that, we want to talk to you about our Patreon.
Yeah, right. Before we get into the discussion, which we are, I think, both itching to go do, we just want to let all of you know about our current bonus series on Patreon. Really, it's one we've just started. There's one episode out at this point, and this is a series that we're doing on Sherlock Holmes and really Sherlock's intersection with speculative fiction. It is a team-up series that Brandon and I are doing with Brent. Brent is my co-host on Hanging Out with the Dream King, which is our Neil Gaiman podcast. And the reason that we're doing it as a team-up is the culmination of this bonus series is Neil Gaiman's Sherlock Holmes versus the Cthulhu Mythos story, A Study in Emerald. So if you join us now on Patreon, you'll be just in time to catch this series as it starts. You'll also get access to the, I don't know, 100, 150 or so other bonus episodes. That includes our bonus series on At the Mountains of Madness by H.P. Lovecraft, and really just tons of other awesome stories that we've had the privilege to talk about.
Yeah, stories and TV shows. It's a real, real blast over there on Patreon. You'll also, at a certain level, get access to the Discord server and early access to different shows. It's absolutely worth your while, we think. I mean, we kind of hopefully designed it that way. So please, if you're thinking about it, at least check out the page, see what we have to offer, and then join us, hopefully. We'd love to have you over there. We'd love to talk with you more in our Discord server and yeah, we put a lot of work into it. So, you know, it's there for your enjoyment, and we hope you'll take the time to at least check it out. But let's get back to the discussion here of the new people. So we're talking about kind of, you know, the rules of a haunted house, maybe a little bit after the story ends. But, you know, this isn't your typical situation for a haunted house story where, like, you know, the economic necessity causes people to move to a new place or to move into a home where a violent death has occurred. It's not like the Amityville Horror or The Conjuring, even, of which I'll say the haunted house portion of that movie, The Conjuring, really works for me. I think it's a near masterpiece. But this is actually instead about upward mobility and consumerism, in a sense. This isn't a story about bottoming out and being left on the fringes of society and having to move to a cheap farm or something along those lines, or buying a murder house at a bargain price. The house in this story is a kind of trap, to be sure, but there's no sense that the apprentices are being like punished by society for being greedy or something along those lines. Or at least I don't quite get that sense that there's kind of like some kind of moral castigation being put upon the apprentices. You know, Distel talks about wanting to have bought the house with aim so that no one else could be brought into these mad games. You know, Distel is kind of this weird figure that's kind of straddling the line between how do I keep doing these terrible things and also maybe not hurt people that we know. But Ames wants some new blood in the neighborhood. And I guess what I'm saying is this, that if we can look at the house as a kind of trap, anyone could have fallen into it, right? If the house is there to attract a family that the weird cult in the neighborhood can torment, literally anybody could have been written into this role, right? But Beaumont seems to have something specific on his mind about who the apprentices are as victims in this wicked neighborhood. So I guess my question to you is this, Glenn, to open the discussion. Do you think Beaumont is really just trying to tell us a particular story of this particular neighborhood and this particular family? Or do you think this is microcosmic? Is Beaumont pointing to some larger critique about American post-war life in the suburbs, and the apprentices kind of represent certain elements of that culture, maybe of the nuclear family or something like that?
This is a great question. And I'm just going to say up front that, yeah, I think this is very Twilight Zone-esque. And that's an easy thing to say because Charles Beaumont is really, you know, one of the important voices of the Twilight Zone. So, of course, it feels Twilight Zone-esque. It's probably better to say the Twilight Zone feels Charles Beaumont-esque. But my point is that this feels like it has some kind of social critique to it. I want to back up just a little bit, Brandon, because you're right to say that there's no real emphasis on some kind of economic hardship here about why this family has moved into this house. But that is hinted at here. It's clear that this is a family that's moving from a cramped apartment and a bad apartment that they didn't like very much, but that also this was a house they could only afford because of the bloodstain that won't go away, and they didn't have another option. It was this house or no house. And, you know, the story opens with Hank wishing that he had said, actually, I think no house would be better than this house. But he couldn't do that. He couldn't deny Anne. But that's not really emphasized in the story. And that was actually a little strange to me, I think just in part because we're so used to those types of cues. I think in particular from on-screen haunted house stories, right? Where we have to be given some kind of reason why the family's making this move to this house that everyone in the area, all the locals know, you know, no one should ever move into. So why has this family bought it? Some of that is here, but it's not emphasized very much. So I don't think that's a part really of what Beaumont is going for here. In fact, if anything, that's really just to explain to a contemporary audience why anyone would move into a house that has a bloodstain from a suicide, because I think most readers of the magazine that this was published in, that would be a deal breaker for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing that Beaumont is doing with the kind of playing with the haunted house tropes a little bit, and especially the economics behind, you know, how haunted house stories explain what's going to happen to their victims or why they're already in an unfortunate situation, is that Beaumont, in part, is looking at Anne's role in her drive for upward mobility. Like in that scene where the neighbors are bringing housewarming gifts over, she's like, oh, we've been wanting this for centuries. Like she says that, I thought this was going to be a family of vampires, that like the apprentices were going to be this kind of new, like, mode of the American middle class, like as a, you know, this as a bloodsuckers, the same way, you know, Dracula kind of represents the new aristocracy or old aristocracy, just kind of like draining the life force of civilization or something like that, that this was going to be Beaumont's critique of, you know, this kind of middle class consumer drive as making them vampires. You know, the new people would be a play on that, in contrast to this comment about wanting like a salad spinner for centuries or something like that. You know, it's really funny, and it could have gone that way given how Beaumont opens the story. But, you know, and why Davies adopted, you know, there's a lot of different directions that Beaumont could have gone in. But no, Anne is really just focused on, the phrase we use is keeping up with the Joneses, right? She wants to look and seem affluent, you know, and that's a kind of woman, you know, she's not able to have her own children. So they adopt, and then she's now going to be this, you know, stay at home mom. And there's a lifestyle being sold about that in the 1950s in America. And Beaumont is kind of looking at the health of that, maybe a little bit.
And one thing that we should say about this neighborhood that they've moved into is, well, maybe we should say several things about this neighborhood. And one of them is that these homes are largely new or newer construction. Like, this is part of the post-war boom. This suburban community has really only just recently been constructed. Also, the Prentices seem to be younger than most of their neighbors, not maybe significantly, but, you know, 10 years, maybe even 15 years younger than some of these other couples. And so these are couples who have kept up with the Joneses. These are people who have affluent jobs, important positions. I mean, now these are people at the height or even the end of their careers. And they've been good careers, or at least, you know, financially lucrative careers at any rate. And they are people who have had all of these serving dishes, have had the nice home, have had it for a decade or more, maybe even their whole lives. And part of what's going on here, at least if we can believe Distel's story, if we take it at face value, is that ultimately that actually was pretty hollow and empty for all of these people. Anne isn't there yet. For Anne, this is still something that matters. This is something of substance to her. It's something she wants. It's something that gives her meaning. These people have gone through some phase like that and have found that hollow, found that empty, found that shallow, and have come out the other side trying to look for some other means of filling their lives with something that is meaningful. And, you know, rather than start a book club, sponsor the symphony, you know, what they're actually doing is robbing banks and guillotining prostitutes and so on. So, you know, there's some real dark humor there, even as Beaumont is saying something, I think, rather serious about this empty materialism that has come to dominate post-war America.
I mean, it's funny because it's kind of being sold to Anne here as fulfilling, ultimately fulfilling and satisfying, as even like a replacement for sexual intimacy, right? As that this is kind of can slip in and be as fulfilling as an intimate relationship with your partner, right? And so I wonder then, if we're thinking about that, you know, why is Hank impotent? You know, how does that work in the story? But then also, what point is Beaumont making maybe about the masculine side of American culture in this kind of new post-war suburban advertisement-based reality?
I have lots of questions about this. And for one, I actually misread the ending of this story. I mean, maybe not misread it. I just misinferred, I guess, and thought that when Distel was saying, hey, we needed a virgin to sacrifice, I just for a moment thought that they meant Hank themselves. But then, of course, it becomes clear that they mean Anne. And of course, what that actually tells us, right, is that Hank has had this medical issue since he and Anne got married. So it's not something that's developed later in life through, you know, all the means that is something that can happen. And so, yeah, I just immediately started wondering about this medical condition that Hank has, this erectile dysfunction, and where it came from. And I suggested in the recap, right, that this maybe came from the war. I mean, you know, either of the recent wars, the Second World War, probably more likely the Korean War, but that's not explicit here. But I wondered if for a contemporary audience, if that would seem more obvious as the reason for this than it does to us. And if there was something there about war and how war itself has shaped suburbia there. I mean, none of it, as I say, explicitly on the page, but I couldn't help but think about that as this is such a central part of the story.
It's really tough to say. I mean, obviously, to a contemporary audience, I mean, these stories were written to be sold. And then, like, I don't think Beaumont thought you and I would be sitting here reading The New People like 70 years later. You know, right. and this art is this kind of writing, this kind of story is kind of meant to be kind of lost to time in a sense. It's for the immediate audience. It's out of publication. Maybe someday you'll get a retrospective. Maybe not. You never know. Like how many writers in these magazines we just haven't heard of, you know, or they wrote five stories in their whole life and got them published. You know, there's this, all this other stuff that's caught up in why this story, why Beaumont has, you know, kind of survived to get a Penguin Classics edition and so forth. But the point I'm making is that this is for the immediate audience who would have all of this cultural context that doesn't need to be explained, including like the more recent, you know, Jake character from The Sun Also Rises would probably be a more familiar type of trope. The impotent war vet, like navigating post-war life and so on. But I don't see anything within the text that would lead me to believe that Hank is impotent because of a war wound. Rather, I see him being drained of his potency because of his role in society in some sense, that like he's no longer valued perhaps for his masculine power, his vitality or something like that, but rather his value lies in his ability to make sure his wife can get a nice home and salad spinners. And so like I feel like Beaumont is attempting to look at this restructuring of society and domestic life and how maybe it's kind of moved to a kind of feminine focus, because at this point in history, by and large, I think women had more time to kind of absorb the advertisements, and a lot of consumer goods were aimed at housewives. And there's this sense that that's now what women want that I see in this story, and not kind of male vitality or something like that. If they ever wanted it, I don't know. I mean, what do I know? But I feel like Beaumont is kind of maybe trying to look at that sort of dynamic, the male-female relationship in society and how that's been restructured in some sense in this consumer boom in the 1950s. But I wonder, I don't know if you have any thoughts about that or if I'm way off base or something.
Right. I guess that's what I was trying to get at in an oblique way, which is that for me, I don't see that explicit in the text either, or even implicit in the text, because as far as we can tell, right, Hank has had this erectile dysfunction since he entered into this domestic life, right? And so I think the reading that you've got, that would need to be supported, at least for me, I would need that to be supported by the idea that this is actually something that has happened to him since they've entered into this Keeping Up with the Joneses kind of life, since they entered into this domestic life that's actually really heavily influenced by advertising and materiality, and to really think of it as actually a type of impotence, a type of powerlessness where his vitality is being sapped from him because of the way that society is being structured. But of course, then that doesn't work for the plot. So it's not, you know, it's not there for that. And so, you know, it's conceivable that the gimmick of the story maybe gets in the way a little bit of the themes that Beaumont is trying to explore here. And I'm happy to let him off the hook there and let him have his cake and eat it too, because I think that your reading of this, although I don't think it's supported by the text, and in fact, I think maybe the opposite, is the reading of the story otherwise that I also actually prefer.
Well, I won't go into my arguments for why two lines about housewarming gifts support my reading, because it may not be that strong as it turns out. We'll talk about Beaumont's craft at the very last thing here about how these hooks work or don't work to kind of communicate what he's trying to get across in this story. But let's move on from the family here and kind of look at the neighborhood a little bit, because it seems to me as though what is driving Ames to kind of create this cult that he's built in the suburbs is a way to avoid boredom, right? This is the question that he uses to attract people and to bring them into his regime. You know, like, what is going on here, I guess, with Ames and boredom? Why is boredom the hook? Why is asking a man at a party, you have to be a little bit bored with your life. Have you considered, you know, sleeping with my wife, maybe? Why is that work? Why does Beaumont think that that will work as a kind of way in to this kind of total depravity and corruption that this neighborhood has fallen into?
Yeah, I can't imagine going to someone's housewarming party and saying that to them. I also can't imagine having someone come over and say that to me. Though also, we just don't have housewarming. Like, we just don't, you know, I'm right with Jake here. Like, I'm just going to lock myself in the room while this is going on. I'm going to go down to the basement and talk with Brandon about some 70-year-old short stories is what I want to do tonight. But no, I mean, it's weird, right? That Ames is the leader of this this thrill-seeking club, we should say, and really just the leader of this community. Yeah, it's a weird line, but Ames has this idea here that, you know, boredom is this real like disease that affluent suburban Americans are all afflicted by or will be afflicted by, that it's going to get to all of them. But he also calls it a sin, and in fact says being bored is the only sin that there is. And so you can do anything you want so long as you excuse it by saying, I was bored, which, That's no basis for a moral philosophy or a civilization to exist. I mean, what a terrible idea that is. I mean, it's just like real. I don't know if this is. I don't know if we would call that existentialism in some way. Maybe nihilism might be closer to it. But it does seem like Ames must be someone who has some real charisma, some charm to him, that he's able to talk people into these schemes. Some of that, of course, is filtered through the way that Distel is telling the story, as if he and everyone else has been kind of victimized by Ames's delusion here and, you know, just total lack of moral compass, and also baby-stepping them into shooting down airplanes or blowing up airplanes and guillotining prostitutes and so on. But it's difficult to imagine this actually happening. But nonetheless, I think Beaumont really is pointing to something here, which is the emptiness of these lives and the boredom that really is rotting out these people as individuals, rotting out their domestic lives at home, but also eroding any real sense of community as well, right? When what we're told makes for a good life is buying stuff for your home, that undermines our ability to have and to value real human relationships that are just about regular everyday things.
Yeah, I mean, I think Beaumont is weirdly right about the cure for boredom in this story. Boredom is maybe the result of loneliness and feelings of isolation and alienation that's kind of caught up in your typical postmodern critique of the West, essentially. That's come, you know, that's really the post-war, you know, kind of ennui that sets in and produces a lot of, you know, what we call postmodern philosophy or postmodern critiques of the West. But that's kind of here, is that this is kind of sense of ennui, the sense of boredom, maybe, that's just sinking into our lives. That's the result of institutional decay. That's the result of the breaking down of communities, you know, living in a cul-de-sac 2 miles from the nearest community center. You know, what are people really doing to build community? And the solution to boredom isn't actually like going on the internet and you know, going to a forum or something like that. It's like actually going bowling with your friends, you know, or something along those lines. But what is the barrier that's stopping people from building community? It's this comfort of isolation. And so I think Beaumont is right about the kind of solution, building a community, getting involved in it. But obviously domestic terrorism is not the kind of community you want to get involved in, and also not devil worship, I suppose.
Yeah, I don't think we need to emphasize that, but let's just be clear. We don't advocate that. We don't advocate that. You know, yeah, go bowling, start a bowling league, start a book club. That is really what these people need. But I also think that's something that Beaumont is pointing to here, right? Because I think it's really important that this is taking place in suburbia when suburbia is new, right? When people's careers are still in the heart of the city, although here we're talking about LA, so there's some disbursement there already built in. But these are people who live far from where their jobs are, and this is really just a bedroom community. And so what it means is that the cultural life of the city, the social life, the institutional life of the city is all much further away from these people's homes than it was for this class of people just a generation previously, really just before the war, and certainly let alone thinking about 50 or 100 years previously. And I think that's one of the things that Beaumont is pointing to, is that in building these bedroom communities, well, that's all you've really built is bedrooms, and there's not really anything for people to do there. There's no way for people to have community to get involved. There's no sense that there are local churches out here in this suburban area, for example, no community theater, none of those sorts of things. All of the amenities of, you know, high density living together in neighborhoods is missing from suburbia in this depiction of it. And I think that's one of the things that Beaumont is pointing to, that, hey, maybe this isn't actually a good way for people to live. Maybe this isn't where people should be living.
I think that's right. Let's move on here now and consider the speculative elements of this story, of which there's really only one big question to ask. Do you think Ames and his crew raised the devil, or is this just a story of an evil man running roughshod over his small kingdom that he's built for himself in his tiny little suburban neighborhood?
Yeah, this is a great question, because I think the way in which you answer this, I think, determines, you know, how you read this story or what type of story you think this is. I don't think that there's any real speculative or fantastical element to the story. I think this is about, well, it's about a murder club. That's what this is about. This is just murdering people for fun because they're bored. So no, I don't think that the devil worship itself is actually doing anything in the world. This is all just play acting for them, though it's conceivable that they've bought into this in some way. But no, I don't think they've actually raised the devil. What about you?
No, I agree. I don't think they did it. I think they're just coming up with new categories of people to kill because they've gotten into this a little bit. I mean, I think you stay in something like this because you enjoy it. Even if you're like distal and you become an alcoholic and maybe you were one to begin with and you're using drinking and like weak moral justifications to kind of explain away your behavior, you're doing this. You're ultimately doing this because you like it. So I think all these people are evil. They don't need a devil to tell them they're evil. They just needed someone to tell them to be evil. And Ames is doing enough of that. I mean, Ames might be the devil, right? I mean, he's very much could be the type of person who is looking to be possessed as a way of explaining his own evilness. But at the end of the day, Ames is just an evil, evil man trying to corrupt other people. And that's devilish, at least.
It certainly is. Though I think that if we're going back to thinking about the contemporary audience of this piece in the, you know, mid to late 1950s, that how do groups of humans, just regular ordinary humans, turn to evil and turn to villainy and perpetrate crimes against other people on a massive and unprecedented scale? That's a question that everyone is grappling with in a very visceral and immediate way, right? And you know, here I'm thinking specifically about Nazis and also about other wartime atrocities of the Second World War, that this is something people are pondering. They're trying to figure out how this happened to regular German people, how they became this. So again, here I think this is Beaumont showing that happening to Americans in the suburbs as well, where the whole story of Ames and how he's gotten people who are just engineers and Hollywood writers and accountants and so on to also become people who rob banks, shoot down airplanes, burn down warehouses, guillotine prostitutes, and sacrifice people to the devil, is really happened. This has really happened in the same way that you get people to perpetrate the Holocaust. It's these baby steps, and it's having a charismatic leader who's appealing to something that they find wrong or missing or, you know, just absent from their life, and that here's a way you can fill it, and let's keep taking one step further until we've gotten to this point. So yeah, again, I think Beaumont is holding up, a mirror here for contemporary readers in the 1950s that would really matter to them.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's an excellent point that I hadn't really considered. But absolutely, people who are going to be in their 40s and 50s and maybe even kids who, you know, saw their grandparents or parents fight in the war or something like that are going to be reading this and thinking, yeah, this is something we have to tackle as a society. How do we guard against this? And this is presented in a fantastic way, this kind of evil in this story. But yeah, this is not about supernatural evil. This is clearly about things people are capable of doing without, you know, we're just needing a little push over the edge. And, you know, what does that say about humanity? It's a great point to bring up. Well, the last thing I want to talk about is the craft of this story. And really, it's just the thing that we've been talking about is Beaumont's technique of overwhelming the opening of this story with mystery and possibility and hooks. And we've kind of, I guess, had a little bit of critique of that as we've been going along in our discussion, but let's just kind of put it out plainly. How does this serve or not serve the story? How does this technique work for you as a reader? But also with your writer cap on, how would you pull this off? Do you think you're capable of it?
Well, no, I definitely don't think I'm capable of writing a story this good. I mean, I think this is a masterpiece of a story. And I think you can see here a lot of the hallmarks of a Twilight Zone episode. Again, that's, you know, no accident. Charles Beaumont wrote a lot of the Twilight Zone episodes and had his stories adapted into them. But just even more broadly speaking, this feels very much like it's meant to be adapted into a 30-minute or, you know, 25-minute television episode. It's clearly got a three-act structure. The story is largely told through dialogue, which certainly makes it very easy to adapt to television. But then it also has these very clearly telegraphed story hooks at the beginning to let us know what kind of story we're going to be getting, but then immediately has the subversion of that and this dramatic revelation at the end about what is actually going on here, right? So there's kind of two twists, two revelations, one of them, you know, a little more dramatic than the other in this story as well, all of which I think is handled masterfully, but really feels like the television of the day.
I agree with you 100%. I don't know if I could pull this off. I mean, the way that Beaumont just kind of front loads the story with, like, it could be anything, and then does your classic kind of Twilight Zone twist. He's like, but you didn't see this coming. Very, very, very strong technique, very strong craft. The party stuff is all great. It's hard to write a party scene with a lot of characters and make it feel alive and not just that people are waiting to come on stage. You know, he does a really good job of keeping the activity going in the story, even as we're seeing Hank in the kitchen kind of off to the side. You feel like you're at this party. That is hard to do. It's amazing. It's an amazing bit of work. And then the kind of crazy ending and the way everything comes together. Yeah, this is a great story. It might not serve its themes super well because we're struggling to kind of agree on what the deeper thematic content of the story is, but that's fine. This is the kind of story that, I don't know, I love this sort of story, even as this is kind of the darker variety of it. This is a great, great bit of writing. And it really reminds me that I need to, like, as a writer developing my own technique and skill, it reminds me to go back to this kind of formula-based writing, you know, to just get the basic beats down pat so you're free to do all the other stuff you want to do as a writer. And this story kind of was a wake up call for me. It's like, oh yeah, go back to that basic 3B. 600 words of the story need to be this. 800 words need to be this, you know, and like just really, pattern writing, I guess you call it, where you can then go back and fill everything in. And I think that's what you're referring to here, Glenn, as well, that like when you see this type of pattern writing done so well, it's kind of inspiring. It reminds you what can be done with kind of a limited form.
I agree. And you and I, of course, are readers who actually really quite like structure and form. I know there's a big segment of the internet of internet fandom that doesn't like that doesn't like tropes and so on. But I don't think that's us. And maybe that's just because we're middle-aged. Maybe if our 20-something selves heard us having this conversation, be shaking our fists at our middle-aged selves. But no, I think this is an absolute masterpiece. As I said at the top of the show, I had never read Charles Beaumont before. So I was very grateful to have this nomination from a Patreon supporter. This volume you mentioned earlier, Brandon, we read this out of the Penguin Classics volume, Perchance to Dream. It's not all of the stories of Charles Beaumont. It's selected stories of Charles Beaumont. It's a great volume. I don't just mean that the stories are great, though I did read a few others in here, but also it's got a foreword by Ray Bradbury, an afterword, a really actually heartfelt afterword by William Shatner. So it's a great volume. I'm so glad to have had it. And I hope that our Patreon supporters will send us back here for more. I would love it.
Yeah, I think we both would. And now that we're hoping for more Charles Beaumont and hoping for our supporters to get us there, let's call it a day here. So that's going to do it for this episode. Once again, I'm Brandon Buda.
And I'm Glenn McDorman. As always, you can find us and our other creative projects at claytemplemedia.com. And please do come over and join us on Patreon at patreon.com/claytemplemedia. You'll gain access to well over 100 bonus episodes. And that includes our new series on Sherlock Holmes, as well as the older bonus series we've done on H.P. Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness, Alan Moore's Swamp Thing Run, and so on. Next time here, we will be back with the first of two commissioned episodes on Laird Barron's novella, The Men from Porlock. And after that, we'll be back with our regularly scheduled episode on A Short Guide to the City by Peter Straub. Until then, we greet you and say farewell.